Accession number 28729, Reel 1.
Ray Bidette, Reel 1. Ray, can you tell me when and where you were born, please?
Actually, I was born not in this house, but in this town in 1931.
And the town is?
Bollock. That's a good idea. Yeah. I was actually born on the park we were talking about before.
Can you tell me something about your family's circumstances?
Yes, they came from the Midlands in the north. They were brought down here by one of their relations, who was my great uncle, who took over the managementship of the hosiery factory called Kayser Bondor. Prior to that, it was called the Full Fashion Hosiery Company. That was in 1928, and I always thank my lucky stars that they did come down here, because the male side came from the mining side of the industry, and the ladies, the women, came from the yarn, knitting, weaving, lace making. And we had an environment that was second to none, actually on a park, gorgeous park with elm trees, cricket pitches. It was a gorgeous environment. It was a kid's delight. I can remember we had one stump of a tree that was our fortress when we were about five or six. And the gangs used to fight for this fortress, which is to put their flag on the top. And you can actually sneak in the bottom of the trunk and climb up inside the tree and get to the top. And they had the buttresses and the peepholes. And we were firing bows and arrows at each other. Imagine doing that today. Bows and arrows. I thank my lucky stars that I was actually brought down here.
What was the family home like?
I was the only child. Spoiled to death. My mother even used to clean my shoes, even when I went right to the age of the army, 18. And one thing I liked about the fact that if you came home late, well, half past 9, 10 o'clock in those days, my mother never used to say to me, "Where have you been?" And she used to say, "Have you enjoyed yourself? Did you meet some nice people?" And I thought, "What a lovely, they were lovely parents." The Midlanders and the Northerners were very open against the Southerners here. And they were actually treated as foreigners down here for a long while. But the hosiery factory provided a social life, a livable life. They earned good money. And they went through the throes where the country was going through a terrible turmoil in 1930s, 1931, where they had the mass strikes and the war, the marches. But down here, it didn't affect them at all, because they had a very good board of control. The directors were all, again, all Northerners, and they'd been through it, and they were determined not to be enticed that way. And they found that they could sell their goods abroad, which didn't affect their standard of living down here as much as the poor devils who were around us. But one thing I'd like to say, it was the most amusing, because when my father came down here, there were actually regular workers in industry. But the people down here, the locals, were all agricultural people, working on farms and allotments and so forth. And the boss, a chap called John Goodenday, came down here, and the factory was empty. All the production had stopped. And he wanted to know why, so he asked the manager at that time, who wasn't my uncle at the time, where's everybody gone? They said, "Oh, they've gone gleaning on the fields to pick up the remains of the harvest." Because the sun was shining, they went out. They were more to the weather rather than to the clock. And they said, "We cannot make this work like this." So that's why he got in touch with my great uncle, who had retired. He had his own firm called the Mansfield Hosiery Company. And he was enticed out of retirement. And he brought the rest of all the family down here. And it was a big family. That's what I couldn't make out, because my mother had seven relations, sisters and brothers, and my father had eight. And I was the only one of ours. Probably said, "We're not having another one like him."
What about your education, Ray? Your early education?
Started at the age of five. I went to an infant school that had only just been turned over from the Church of England authorities to the local authorities. Pleasant little school, two school rooms, two classrooms. And the teachers were dedicated people, lovely people. And then we went to the juniors, again taken over by the local authorities some years previously, not too long. So we had the church influence. Again, a very enjoyable time. I can't remember being bullied. I can't remember, this is strange, because you, so much bullying going off. And all throughout my life, I've never had the bullying situation. I suppose basically because I was rather forward, outgoing child, tallish as well, and sporting. I liked sport, so therefore that, I suppose that helped.
What did you like to do?
Obviously football. Wasn't so good at cricket. Loved, later on, I loved the racket games. Squash, badminton, tennis. Running. I was quite a good athlete on that. And then we went to the senior school, which was a secondary modern. Again, the teachers were dedicated. And in the early days, the regular teachers, all the males, disappeared because it was the wartime, 1939. And we got, I don't know what they call them now, teachers that came in at the moment's notice, retired and brought out of retirement. We had a good education in so much, it was a good grounding. We were not so much sort of academically taught, but we were streetwise, which I liked. Again, sports was a very great influence on my life. And I remember I broke the high jump record. And I thought it was so good at about 5 foot three. And then in the papers, they were jumping at 6 foot. And I thought, ooh, when they broke the 6 foot barrier, I thought that was, I never got to that. I did 5'11", but I could never go over 6 foot.
You were a youngster in the late 30s. Were you aware of the sort of situation in Europe at the time, the war coming, that sort of thing?
Oh, so much that it was a great big fun game. It was, my father built his own shelter. Being a miner, he could go down three times faster than anybody else, and I was amazed the speed he went down the ground and put this ARP shelter up. And of course, my gang used to go down there. We used to have a cup of tea down there. My mother used to bring them down, and we were either in submarines or anything with the imagination, kids. We didn't see much. We saw a few scattering of aircraft, dogfights above us. We had a few bombs dropped. Being in the country, 37 miles away from London, we were not affected. We saw a lot of movement of troops. In fact, all the large houses around here had troops in them. I can remember the mother pointing out, after a rather noisy bomb had dropped about 5 miles away, and then we looked beyond that, and the glow in the sky, as if the sun was coming up, and it was only 2 o'clock in the morning, around about that time, and it was the glow from the fires of London, the East End and the docks. And you didn't think you could see it from 37 miles away, but you could see the glow in the sky. And when you realised the damage that happened, it would shine anywhere, I think, really.
What nationality are the troops that were based around here?
I remember the Manchester lot, the Manchester regiment were down here in the High Street. A lot of the engineers, Royal Artillery. There was some movement of the Leicestershires as well. I remember that. I don't remember them, actually. I'm just going by looking in the old books and finding out what movement the troop movement was. They didn't have a lot of influence of the town because they kept to themselves. We had more influence when the Americans came down, because I don't know, we looked at them in wonderment. Remember, there's still a famous place down here called the Georgian Dragon. Been here hundreds of years, really. And we used to hang around there and ask the Yanks for any gum chum. I remember one chap come walking towards me, and even at the age of 8 or 9, I thought, what a a good-looking man he was. He was. He had lovely uniforms, these officers did. And I asked him for some gum, and he said he hasn't got a gum, but he gave me a dollar. And I had a little book there, which is my autograph book, and I thought, he looks somebody I should know. I don't know why, but... And it was Clark Gable. It was actually Clark Gable, because he was not 5 miles away. There was airfields all around here. Well, to the north of us, anyway. Several other famous people. I remember that there was a commotion in the forecourt, and they were filling his car up with whiskey in the petrol tank. They couldn't get petrol, but they had to get back to the base. And this woman was laughing, and we couldn't help noticing. And we found out that she was Lana Turner. Although a lot of people won't know who these people are, but I couldn't get her autograph. That was good fun with when we were kids. Really marvellous, because we could understand why the anxiety of the adults. And the food situation was good, because living in the agricultural area, you could get plenty of vegetables. And as they said, dig for victory. My father was a good gardener. And the front and the rear garden were turned into allotments. And of course, we had plenty of vegetables. You had to wait for them sometimes, because... But we had plenty of game as well. Rabbits and chickens. And also, I noticed that... Well, my mother used to say that the allowance you got with cheese and lard and butter and so forth was greater than most people had had previous to the war. So they were living better, really, if you could get it. And it was a hard life on them, because my mother used to go out every day and queue up for sugar and so forth that she couldn't get normally. But to me, to the children, it was a marvellous period.
Was the blackout observed?
Oh, yeah. You know, my father couldn't get in the forces. He's grade 3. I mean, due to an accident in the mines. And so he became an ARP warden. And they used to go around every night tapping on the doors and say, you've got a kink, you're showing light. And if they failed, they could actually summon them, you know, put them in court. And so. No, it was funny, because when... even people were proud of that, they... The blackout curtain used to, the actual material used to fade, and it used to start going yellow. I remember my mother getting that old stuff down and didn't know what to do with it. And at that time, we saw a film called The Mark of Zorro with, I'm trying to remember the name, the star of it. Anyway, so it was an influence to us, and so with these blackout material, we all made cloaks. Oh, a lot of us, a dozen of us, had these cloaks. And like Sandeman Port and so forth, with the big hat and so forth. And just up the road, there was an industrial estate, and they used to make tubing for brake pipes and so forth. And it was called Bundy Tubing. And with this tube, we used to make them into swords. And the pistol, the handguard, we made out of old cocoa tins and rounded them off and wrapped rope on the handle. The only thing is, if you took a side swipe, the pipe used to kink. My father, he said, that's not, they don't call them swords. He didn't know the difference between a flat bladed sword and an epee. But he went, and he was a blacksmith as well, man of all trades. And he was in there for 2 days making this sword for me. And with great pride, he said, now come and, this is the sword you talk about, this is the one. So I went into his little forge he had in the shed, and he gave me this sword, and mind you, I was only 8, and it was so heavy I couldn't pick it up. It was a broad sword, you know. And the kids wouldn't fight with me, because even when they did get the strength to start swinging it, it used to bend all their blades. I remember one lad, his mother couldn't provide him with blackout, black material from the blackout, but she had some dark red curtains. And they'd gone white, bleached, ready for washing and so forth. And he had a cloak of that red. He was the only one. We always think it's show off. But up the road there, the farm, we used to go chasing the cattle around. And we were running around and trying to round them up. We were rodeo men and cowboys and Indians. And one of these cows wouldn't move. The rest of them would start scattering around, but this one wouldn't move. We couldn't understand why, and it came running towards us. It was a bull. And he went straight after this chap called Carl, who had this red cloak. And we kept shouting at him, drop your cloak, drop your cloak. And he dropped it and got up a tree. And he was up there for about a quarter of an hour before the bully sort of got bored and walked away. Yeah.
Do you remember the VARVJ celebrations at all in 45?
I do, yes, because I was in my 14th year then, and I was, well, 13 and a half on the VA day, and we had a party in the street. I said the street, but really it was it's like a service road running between the houses, nicely contained. And funny, most of the people who lived in that, in the street, were all mostly northerners, Midlanders and northerners. And I always found they were very generous. And the people who lived down here didn't mix all that much. Even though it was a brilliant celebration, it was everybody was sort of happy. The fact that all their suffering had finished. I could feel that at 13 and a half. The VJ one came late on in the year, and I'd already started work then. I was 14 then. I was 14 in September. There didn't wasn't so much of a party then, the VJ. I think the town tried to get something going. And it was sort of a half-hearted thing. I think the people had just had enough, really. They celebrated in their own way. I think they celebrated in so much that the bigger parties were in the big towns and big cities. And the London one was a great success. A lot of people went up there. But going up to London, I think it cost a shilling, which is 5 pence, new money. Even then it was a lot, because I remember my father, he was earning around about £7 a week, where other people were earning £3 a week. And it wasn't far on, because I'm jumping from 14 to 18, and when I went in the army, we were getting paid 28 shillings, £1 and 8 shillings.
What did you do, though, when you went to work? What was your first job?
Well, the factory was only about 30 yards away. It wasn't a noisy factory, not outside. It was inside with the knitting machines. It was a hosiery factory. It employed, at that time, around between 500 and 600 people. Eventually, it went on to over 1,000 people. So it was the mainstay of Bowlock, okay. The main form of employment. There's still a farm, there's still agriculture around here. The environment of the factory was gorgeous. It was, as I said, it was air conditioned. It was all newish. And the people were nice. And they were sort of short of labour, because a lot of the young men were still in the forces. Only the chaps I worked with were either disabled from out the forces and being wounded, ill and so forth. And they got early release. The other chaps didn't come out until 46, 47. I was in the warehouse, excuse me, in the hosiery side, and I'd worked 6 months part-time in the evenings to learn the trade. Profession. I think I was getting a few shillings, 5 shillings, 5 to 10 shillings a week, part time. And then when I worked, started, it was about £1. A lot of women up there. I think there was a lot of women employed in all the factories around here, and all throughout the country, because of the labour shortage of men. There's some lovely personalities there. It was my job to receive the goods from the factory in their finished product, and then we'd rack them, and then the chaps used to come around and pull the orders, we used to say. They had the invoices of the individual shops and stores, and they'd pull the orders out of the racks, and we had to make sure that the goods were in the correct racks. I stood that for probably about 2 or 3 years. And then I went on to dispatch, where you dispatch the goods to the individual shops, check the goods, and then parcel them up. I can still do a good parcel. My wife always says to me, You're going to do the Christmas wrapping. Not as neat as I used to be, but it's a good standard. And I know the knots. Because, of course, just before, around about, you know, between 12 and 14, I was in the senior scouts. And I say that because he helped me in my future life in the army because of the individual training of woodsmanship and setting fire to lighting fires. And we didn't use two scouts to rub together. We used proper stuff, matches and rub two scouts. They always used to say, rub two scouts together. I think that that put me in good stead because I could perform knots with ropes and also pack a good backpack up. I knew how to do that. I knew how to put tents up and so forth. Not as we had tents in the army. We used to make them out of just a little sheet, a poncho sheet, and then leaves later on. As far as the factory is concerned, I mentioned the fact that it was the social side of the factory was gorgeous. They had every conceivable sport up there. And we used to have an international sports day where our factories used to compete against other factories in Wales and Scotland. And we used to have a weekend out in Wales and Scotland. So it used to be an international field event or sports event. Again, I was quite good at high jump and long distance running. I was then a cyclist as well in between. And I actually got paid for being a cyclist. So I was a professional cyclist. This group of people called Peugeot. I didn't even know Peugeot made cycles, but they gave me a frame and wheels and accessories, and I was in these mass starts on the aerodromes and closed area of the roads to close the roads down. Quite a good sprinter, but I became known as a stop man. If you had to try and stop the rest of the team, if they had a break, so they had a break. So the fastest of that team would sprint off, and he'd try and have the support of the rest of the team, and you had to break the team up, and I was called the stop man. I used to stop them by foul means or fair. I enjoyed my school days. I did have a good time at school. I enjoyed the school days. I enjoyed my early work days.
At that time, were you aware that you were going to have to do national service?
Didn't even think about it, no. Now, I think my mother was worried, the fact that she'd read it in the paper where all young men of a certain age were being called up. But I never thought about it. You don't think much of it when you're 14, 15 or 16. And I was racing around the country on my bike. And it was one great bit of fun, I thought. Money wasn't a problem because even though we were earning just over a pound, my parents were very generous. The father earned good money, not terrific money, but he was a very generous man. He wouldn't expect anything in return, but he loved giving presents out. I could see his face at Christmas. That was another thing, remember Christmas. We're up in Mansfield. And I was disillusioned that year because that year I found out there was no such thing as Father Christmas. Because this Father Christmas came in the bedroom and he was slightly drunk and he fell over the rug near the door. I heard him swear and then I heard him ping and I thought, what the hell is that? And he caught his toe on the pot underneath the bed because I was sleeping with my parents in the same room, you see. And I thought, that looks like my dad. I was wide awake, 1 o'clock in the morning. It was my dad, and he was drunk. He used to enjoy himself when he used to visit all my mother's relations in Mansfield. That's not far away from Nottingham. But the presents were so nice, and they were, I say, so generous, that I didn't think too much of it. It's not so bad, as long as you kept giving the present, don't matter who gives them to you anymore. But I went straight away when I found out this out. I told all my friends there's no such thing as Father Christmas, and they nearly sort of destroyed me by hitting me, and of course there is. And I wish they'd kept it on, because it's a lovely feeling that such a thing occurred. A chap with a beard and a red cloak used to come round every shop. When you think of it, it couldn't possibly happen, but you never thought about that. It was just a pleasant thing.
So, you said you didn't know, well, you hadn't thought about your national service.
No.
How were you first informed that you had to do it?
Well, I think you missed some of the chaps. The chaps who were probably a year, 18 months older than you, seemed to disappear for a few weeks, and then you see them in uniform, and thought, oh, they joined up. But it was so scattered, really, in the town. We only had about 2,000 people living here. And they'd appear with uniforms, and then they'd disappear again, and then they'd come back again in civvies, and you think, 2 years, or 18 months, or 2 years, it's gone so quick. And you never thought about it going to happen to you until you received the papers. And it was in the brown, buff envelope on His Majesty's service. And would you appear for a physical examination? And in my case, I went to St. Albans. Then when you realise that you've got to go in the forces, you wanted to, in your back of your mind, you wanted to be fit. You didn't really want to go, but you didn't want to sort of let anybody down, or let yourself down, or your parents down. And Molly didn't want me to go, of course. She was in a terrible state. So I went to I cycled to St. Albans, where everybody went on buses and trains and so forth. And I passed, okay. I remember one thing, though. There's always something that occurs with most people, and you don't know you've got it, but I must have been slightly deaf in one ear, because I was standing there in my nuddy, and this doctor said to me, come over here. So I thought, well, all right. So I walked over towards him, and he was attending to something else. He turned round, and I was rounded just behind him, and he said, what are you doing here? I said, you just said, come over here. So he said, no, I didn't. I said, cover one ear. So then he examined my ear and found out that it was just wax. It was and then I saw him mark something down, and then the nurse said, no, it is wax. That's the first time I've had a warm water shoved in my ears. And it was a lovely feeling, a lovely sensation. And you could hear all the birds singing afterwards. I didn't realise how deaf I was at the time. That was the only complaint. When I went to a selection board, actually on the same day, they asked you where you wanted to go, what service you wanted to do. So I put down Navy. But they said, no, there isn't any vacancies. There are no vacancies in the Navy. I said, what about the RAF, RAF? No, there are no vacancies. But there are in the Army. I said, I don't want to go in the Army. He said, no, you're going to see the Army chap. And I went into this room, and this chap there was with red on his collar. And he must have been a brigadier or something, a high-ranking man. I noticed that he'd got one arm missing and a patch over his eye. And he said, I understand you don't want to go in the Army. I said, well, not so bother going in the Army. I'd rather go in the senior service. Senior service? He was really upset about that. And he said, there's nothing wrong with the Army. And I wasn't quick-witted that way, but it was strange for me to say it, because I wasn't a sort of sarcastic person. But I said, well, he hasn't done you much any good, because he lost one arm and one eye. Oh, no, he said, that's nothing to do with the Army, he said. And I said, oh, I'm glad to say that. He said, well, no, he said, I think you'll be a good chap in the PBI. I thought, PBI? I didn't want to seem ignorant. So I thought, PBI? What's a PBI? That sounds good. So as I came out of the office, there was chaps sitting on forms outside, and said, what you got? I said, I'm going in the PBI. And a bloke at the end started laughing. So I said, what's so funny about that? He said, it's the poor bloody infantry. I thought it was some specialist unit. I thought, that was quick. They're quick to find out they've got something special here, PBI. So anyway, the Army.
What happened next then, Rowan? Then you'd done your selection. Were you requested to turn up for some training at a depot?
Well, you went, yes, you left it alone for a bit. You didn't hear anything from anybody. Then you got a letter, report to Colchester, I had to, and they gave you a rail pass. And I remember my mother saying goodbye to me. It reminded me of the old films of the Welsh miners, where the family are waving goodbye, and my mother was crying. Oh, my dad was hugging me and said, "You'll be all right, son. Never volunteer for anything." And I remember his words: "Never volunteer for anything." He'd never been in the forces, but he told me that.